Hello and welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 18. Today on the show, I have Keenan Robinson, High Performance Director for USA Swimming. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the Freelap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The Freelap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. Hello and welcome to the podcast. Today we have Keenan Robinson, National Team High Performance Director for USA Swimming. Keenan is a coach who is fusing modern strength and conditioning and sports medicine practices with swim performance. He has worked with prominent swim programs such as the University of Michigan, North Baltimore Aquatic Club, and Arizona State University. Not to mention, he was the 2016 head athletic trainer for the USA Olympic contingent in Rio. He is also the strength coach for Michael Phelps, arguably the most successful Olympic athlete of all time. The world of strength training for swimmers is certainly an emergent one, in my opinion. It's been around a long time, but now that strength and conditioning has become more of a modernized profession, swim strength is becoming more of a topic of interest, although it certainly doesn't get the discussion that a lot of the bigger sports or just speed training in general gets, certainly. And I do think that's a little bit because of, one, the popularity of those sports, but also because finding a transfer out of dry land into the water is not as straightforward as what you might see for land-based sports. I know that there's a lot of coaches who listen to this podcast regularly who may not work with aquatic athletes, but I found over the years that the challenge of learning what does make aquatic athletes fast from or out of a functional dry land perspective, it really makes you look under the hood, it makes you look into the subsystems of the body, and it makes you do so very deeply and with a close eye. And I do think that the spillover into the global athletic and coordinative ideas is great for any coach, really. Keenan is an awesome guy to talk to with this stuff. He's got a lot of experience in the sport from both a strength and performance, a long-term athletic development, and a sports medicine perspective. And those are three really important things with working with swimmers. I hope you guys enjoy the podcast. It's an awesome one if you are involved in strength training for aquatic athletes. Even if not, there's great ideas in terms of strength training, injury prevention, long-term athletic development, motor learning, and more. With that said, here we go. All right, Keenan, it's great to have you on the show today. Thanks for being here.
Joel, quite an honor to be on it. Thanks for having me.
Awesome, man. So first question I got for you is talk about your journey training aquatic athletes. What are some of the biggest paradigms over the years that you found to lead you to your current thoughts on strength training and dry land for swimmers?
So my background and my journey comes by route of my educational. So by educational trade, I'm an athletic trainer. I got my undergraduate degree in exercise science and then my master's degree in sports healthcare. And my first job was at the University of Michigan in 2004. As the athletic trainer for swimming and diving. And so not being a swimmer growing up, and not having any aquatic background, it was all learned on the fly. And I was actually lucky to be in the environment that I was in, where I had coaches that could educate me really well, and I had athletes that I had a really good relationship of communication with. Because as you know, the information out there on training swimmers is very dogmatic in nature, and it's either from what coaches have always done or what niche people have done. and oftentimes those don't match up to what we're educated in exercise science, biomechanics, human movement, physiology, et cetera, et cetera. So I think I took the course that many strength coaches that have worked with sports like swimming, where you go and you access the information that's available while sticking to your upbringing in terms of strength and conditioning. So everything that you study for and you learn through the NSCA, you apply. And then over the years, it kind of adapts. So and we've actually been through an interesting era in the sport of swimming where there was kind of two sides of the fence as to whether strength training was necessary or you could just swim and get by on some medicine ball activities and some body weight activities. And then I think roughly around like 2007 through about 2010, that's when all your strength training has to mimic the strokes, and it has to be swim specific. And so I went down that route and then kind of evolved where, okay, I've done it a variety of different ways. I'm going to stick to my own goals. I'm going to plan, apply, watch the organism adapt, and then make modifications after a seasonal plan or after a big macro cycle. So that's kind of where we are today.
That's awesome, Keenan. It's always good to see where people have been, especially because it's, you know, when you talk about the end product, it's nice to say, hey, you know, I've been here, I've seen this. And in a strength and conditioning community that I think is as young as that in swimming, it's great to know that you've been through that. What is the number one thing that makes swim athletes different than land, in your opinion? And how should coaches keep this in mind when working with them in a resistance training setting?
Well, I think the major difference is we're a sport that trains nonstop for about 11 months, 3 weeks out of a year. There is real no off season. And on top of that, the title is strength and conditioning, but the conditioning aspect 99% of the time is taken care of by the sport in and of itself. So I think you can kind of, the conditioning, you know, I don't think we do too much of that within our within our job description or what we do in a job. And so I think that's one major consideration to take in when you're writing a plan. And I think number two is really, really understanding the body's response to the stress imposed upon it and how it reacts. And so kind of the name of the game is functional overreaching to get better at swimming. You want to see how much stimulus you can imply upon it and the adaptation that occurs. And so, you know, you're going to fall through the ice a lot. And that's the thing I tell people, you know, training with swimmers, you're always walking on thin ice with them. So I guess from terms of bioenergetic demands, one thing you have to really consider. And I think from an anatomical standpoint, it's gotten immensely better, where I'm sure just in the time that you've worked with collegiate swimmers, you've seen more and more kids come into the weight room that have done something. Right, wrong, or indifferent, they've at least had some ground-based stress applied to upon them. So that makes it a lot easier, whereas back in like 2005, 2006, these dudes were walking in, they never had anything externally loaded upon them, and so their bone density to withstand that, because they've been in a non-gravity dependent activity for 10 years, so you'd have to be pretty concerned about that. And then their actual muscular ligamentous structure was not durable enough to withstand another completely different stimulus, which is weight training or dry land training, because they've only done one stimulus, which has been swimming. So understanding that their age when they get to you may be just below sport mastery or sport mastery, because they're swimming at Cal, right? Like you don't get to go to Speaker Aquatic Center unless you can bring the heat, right? So sport mastery has been acquired, but weight room mastery, it may not be even close to being even relevant or, you know, something we would say, hey, this is at least okay. So you got to start at the basics, because they can already swim, so you don't want to screw that up. You just want to give them a little bit something that can build upon their athletic ability.
Yeah, I agree with that, Keenan. I really like what you said too about the I think that kids are more and more actually coming into the weight room now more well prepared. You had that old adage of fish out of water, and I think that there's always a few people in the group that certainly fit that prototype, but I found that there's actually a lot more good and adept athletes than I would have expected on the land. And people lift a lot more in high school than I think that they used to coming into programs.
Yeah, and then I'll just get the fish out of water, or they're not good athletes. It's something like fingernails on a chalkboard, although the chalkboards don't even exist. But it's one of the things that, you know, athleticism is athleticism. So don't pigeonhole these athletes because they can't do a box jump. You know, I ask them, you get in the water and swim and tell me how easy that is. Or if you can swim, do a back to breast turn efficiently. That's all athletic movement. So don't pigeonhole these people into saying they can't do this, they can't do that, because they're swimmers. They're unathletic. It's, you know, to me, that's such a BS term. And to me, it's just a coach being lazy, saying, like, I don't want to take the freaking time to go through a progressional development to teach the kid to do this ground-based activity.
Yeah, that's an awesome point. And if swimmers are good at, well, several things, but if they're good at one thing, it's being meticulous to detail, too, and learning things and how to do them right. And I think that that's something that I've definitely learned over time, and it's really been amazing to watch.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And another question I had, another follow-up based on your last answer there, is you talked about kind of there's almost like a little bit of a razor's edge with every stimulus that you put into an athlete in the weight room. And I know you and Jay DeMayo talked about this in terms of the minimal effective dose on a podcast you guys did before, which was really awesome. And especially too, I do like to get into a little bit of nuts and bolts too, just so coaches at home listening can definitely take a few things away in terms of, hey, what's a minimum effective dose in terms of what I might do in terms of sets and reps. So what is your idea for how much is too much, generally speaking, in the weight room for, I mean, I guess it's a broad term, but what is your opinion on how much is too much for, say, just standard barbell lifts that athletes might be doing in the weight room swimmers?
Okay, so I'll kind of parlay that back to maybe my initial statement that if I didn't make clear, I'll make clear now. So the minimal effective dose has to coincide with the dose that's being applied in the water, right? So I think broadly speaking, you're going to have a hormonal endocrine metabolic response to a stimulus, so whether it's in the water or out of the water in the weight room. And then you're going to have a musculoskeletal effect, both in the water, out of the water, and then you're going to have a CNS effect in the water and out of the water. So I think the most important thing you can do starting off is get down on deck and understand the coach's weekly cycle, and within that weekly cycle, the daily stimulus. So I'll just use the program that I was around for forever with Bob and Coach Urbanchek, and that is, you know, Monday they're going to induce aerobic threshold. So we know, generally speaking, that will reset the nervous system. It's the number one component you need to be successful. A strong aerobic background is going to make a strong swimmer. But that can be a little bit fatiguing from the CNS standpoint. And then day two in the water is going to be active rest, so a little bit more taxing on the cardiopulmonary system. Wednesday is going to be quality, so maybe something off the block, something repeat. For people that are middle distance swimmers, maybe they're going to do repeats of 3100s. Then we go back and we recite the microcycle with a Thursday aerobic threshold. Friday for us in our program is a pretty heavy kick set. Might do somewhere between 15 and 2100s long course, best average. So you got to understand what that's going to do, both from a metabolic standpoint and a musculoskeletal standpoint to the legs. And then Saturday, you know, we're doing something quality, probably something off the blocks. So that's first and foremost that you have to understand. Have that down. You should be able to recite it like that, because then that's going to help you set up your weight room cycle. Okay, and then so you have to. I always err on the side of caution and go by the term keep what's important. And in our world and in your world, the 200 breaststroke is what's important. Everything else, a squat, a clean. Anything else is just, you know, icing on the cake or outliers. So keep your weight program simple early on and see what they can do in terms of how well they respond and adapt. You know, most swim coaches, they have times where they have heart rate that they correlate to their training practices, and that's going to be your guideline. And then you can start to – then you have your own measurements of adaptation through training. So are these, you know, are they getting stronger? So can they put more weight on the bar? Something basic and simple as that. Are there movement proficiencies? Can they really squat the way you want them to squat? I think that's got to be individualized to your own coach's eye. I do believe that using something perhaps like the FMS at least gives you a standardized mean, say, can the body get into a position to adapt and withstand stress? So whatever you want to use there, that's the coach's decision. But you got to have your eye, and you got to understand that from an anatomical standpoint, from an anthropometric standpoint, these dudes, and that's not gender specific, dudes and gals, they're freaks, right? So some of them have really narrow and shallow acetabulums, and that's why they're fantastic breaststrokers and IMers. Some of them have tremendous amount of hypermobility in the glenohumeral joint, and that's why they're fantastic at the butterfly. So no exercise you impose upon them is wrong, but you got to make sure that fundamentally they can do those things with the least amount of external resistance and then apply upon it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Actually leads me right into my next question a little bit. And this is what I'm certainly interested in is what are things in the weight room that you may be able to see or generally see successful aquatic athletes do if these exist, such as, you know, pull-ups for sprint freestylers or that type of correlation. Do you see any correlation between any particular lift or movement and athletes who are quite good at a particular stroke?
I think your vertical pulls, and I keep it generalized to that because based upon where they're at in their athletic age, their hand placements, whether you're going to go neutral grip, whether you'll go supinated, whether you go pronated, whether you go narrow in your grip stance, wide in your grip stance, on a vertical pull, so meaning to pull up, chin up, that's going to be the greatest thing because it's your only way you can induce strength of upper body, strength to body mass ratio. And in all four strokes, it's the ability to kind of pull your entire body through an external resistance, aqueous solution. So I think the more and more you can adapt that, the better off the swimmer's going to be. And then if you teach them right, you program it right, it's going to really increase and enhance their scapular stability, their glenohumeral joint stability, and keep them having healthy shoulders. Now, if you try and ginger it up too much and make the activity, the exercise, too fancy, too ballistic, too reactionary, you're going to have dudes up seeing athletic trainers like myself or other healthcare provision athletes, or excuse me, practitioners. I used to, for a while there, I thought that I had a pretty high correlation between a posterior chain, so whether it's hex bar deadlift, sumo squat deadlift, or a straight up deadlift. I thought that really, really was a heavy, very good correlation to our best kickers. And I've now scratched that. I just think that, again, we go back to their anthropometric, those with the greatest amount of total ankle range of motion, and then those that have been given kicking early on in their development as a swimmer, they're the best kickers. No amount of posterior chain. It helps it out, but I don't think it makes the puts them into a category of good swimmer or not good swimmer.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's interesting. I, you know, coming from a track background myself, you know, there's some staples that if you are built a certain way, you're probably gonna be fast. If you have big, strong glutes and long legs, you're probably gonna sprint pretty fast. And then there's similarities in, you know, in the water. If your feet are pointed a certain way or you have a certain mobility, a certain body point, I can get your squat 50 pounds stronger, but it's not necessarily going to do any good unless you have these functional foundational abilities, and or the muscular patterning behind those abilities isn't in the proper sequence. And so I definitely get what you're saying on that one. The next question is a little bit similar too, And that's how much strength is enough when training various swim strokes and distances in terms of some common swimming lifts or lifts that swimmers probably would do, such as weighted pull-ups or front squats. So, or in another way of phrasing that, what are some common lifts that you like to see? And is there any kind of minimum baseline like, hey, I'd like to see you do, generally, I'd like to see you do this. And once you get past this level of strength, yeah, you know, we're pretty good on that. We don't have to necessarily worry about pumping up that one rep max.
Yeah, it's funny you asked that because I just, 3 weeks ago, I was in Atlanta with Jay DeMeo, and we kind of talked about this. And then I've been going back and forth on email with Nate Brookreason down there at NC State. And we kind of all came to the conclusion that when they start off, well, let's say that when they get there as freshmen, that we have to teach them how to lift. And the immediate benefit of that, they're just going to get stronger, especially if they've never lifted before. And even if they've lifted before, odds are it's been a pretty unregimented, unstructured, and probably poor technical background, right? So if they haven't lifted before, you're just going to get them stronger, and so they'll get a little bit faster in the water just because their levers are bigger and stronger. If they had lifted before and you do a good job of cleaning up their movement patterns in the weight room, then their neuromuscular efficiency in the water is going to carry over to the neuromuscular efficiency in the water. They'll probably get better because their extremities can get in the right position that the coaches want them to in terms of stroke and biomechanical changes that they do at the collegiate level. And then they kind of start to progress through that, and you start to be able to kind of modulate their loads. You can start doing some dynamic effort stuff. You can start doing some max effort stuff in accordance with their adaptation to training. And then I think you get to a point where they've achieved sport mastery, right? So we go back to Anatoly Bondarchuk's description of sport mastery, right? The dude that you worked with that went to Rio and won medals, they've achieved sport mastery. So now we need to go back to They've really achieved everything that they possibly can in the weight room that will translate to faster swimming, right? Like, so if you take a Nathan, for instance, and he goes from a, whatever, like a 400 squat to a 420 squat, is he really, really going to get much faster in the 1500 freestyle? Maybe not. Now, if you make him more durable, then he can withstand the swimming stimulus on a more frequent basis, so you can do the high CNS activity stuff more frequently and bounce back, then you got a shot for longevity. Then you got a shot for the ability to drop the time, right? And because once they get to a certain level, it just drops in tenths and hundreds. It's not like they're going to make a huge drop in the 200s and down. I mean, right, like, Chase, the dude I worked with, there was a silver medalist in the 400 IM, where, yeah, he dropped, I think, like 3.5 seconds from his lifetime best in Rio to in silver. But like, that wasn't a factor of him getting stronger, him being able to do, he can't squat because of his just anatomical deficiency. He was just able to withstand the training stimulus of swimming on a more frequent basis at a higher level. That's how he got swimming.
Awesome. On the topic of strength training as well, we know that swim benches don't work. For those of people who don't know who a swim bench is, I assume most people familiar with the swimming community would, but basically a bench that slides as you do a very swim-specific motion on it. But what is your take on other types of training, specific positions or movements within the weight room setting?
So I mean, that kind of falls into my aquatic posture catalog of activities, and that would be the closest thing that maybe someone from the outside world would look in and say, oh, that's swim specific. So it has a lot to do with basically increasing the spinal stability of the swimmers, because we know that the one of the top three highest pathologies in swimmers is shoulder, medial knee pain, low back issues. So and you look at the movement patterns that they have to do with the long axis strokes, so back and free, there's going to be a lot of torsion in the lumbar, thoracic spines. And so you're going to have that type of stress, wear and tear on the vertebral disc. And then on the short axis strokes, you've got your breast and your fly. You know you're going to have a lot of flexion and extension movement patterns, primarily in the hip extensors as well as the lumbar spine to pick up a lot of that slack when fatigue sets in. So what we do is we work on stabilization of those body parts while the extremities are moving. And so it's nothing great or real fancy or real cool. Like, you wouldn't find much of it on YouTube. But it's making sure that I can check and I can go through our different segments, whether it's cervical rotation or cervical stability. People get to kind of think of that when they're doing their long axis strokes, even their short axis strokes, again, getting a lot of extension. And making sure that is in accordance to what the limitations are from an anatomical standpoint of those different segments throughout the spine.
Yeah, I think the idea of training those movements with the idea of posture and position is monumental. More so than just raw force, because if you're training raw force on the land with gravity and different modulation, I think it becomes a little bit different movement from a intermuscular standpoint. But yeah, what you said, going to the core and going to the position, I think that kind of changes the world of it a little bit. And I've certainly seen that make a big difference for athletes.
Yeah. I mean, just kind of look at, and you know, so yeah, we start at the core, but then you kind of look at their scapular kinematics, so each individual's shoulders mm-hmm. work. And I know in a collegiate setting, it's a little bit more challenging because you got 30 bodies. You know, with your more elite end or your sport mastery end athletes, you really want to take into consideration their scapular kinematics and what their actual anatomical range of motion is in hip flexion and extension. Because I think that's going to come into play when you're programming mm-hmm. specific exercises for those movement patterns so that you don't induce more stress or have the lumbar spine pick up more of the slack because you're trying to get some amount of hip extension that's just not going to get there. No matter what you do, no matter what type of voodoo or secret potion smoking gun you think you can apply on it, it's just the way it is, right? Like the acetabulum, the femur, like that's what God made them as. So like you think you're going to get it, but your odds are somewhere up or below the chain, you know, it's picking up the slack and inducing some sort of wear and tear and stress.
Keenan, if you could change one thing that you commonly see performed in aquatic strength training regimes, what would it be?
I would say the jumps, the plyometric, the bounds, that domain of general physical preparation. The reason why I say that is one, do they have the requisite strength to even begin to do those activities? Number two, is their anatomy ready to go with that? And the reason why I say that is it kind of goes back to the participating in a primarily non-gravity dependent activity, especially with the female population. So you know their endurance activities, so you know how that can affect their bone structure. Even the 18-year-olds that are walking in on your campus at that time. So doing a bunch of jumps and doing a bunch of plyos too soon might pick up a stress fracture. And then just their basic fundamental movement patterns on land. Are they comfortable in a landing position or do they go into that valgus position? Do they know how to generate the force through dorsiflexion or are they overly pronating because they have that hypermobility in the subtalar joint? But all those things that go through, I think the jumps, the bounds, and then overall, do we really know that the power develops through those? So that's pure power right there. Do we know that it translates to the water? Maybe a little bit more in the short course because you have walls, but we don't know that for sure, right? So are you programming something just to program it, or have you taken – have you investigated your implementation of it, and then have you coached it and progressed the human body well to start doing that stuff?
Yeah, jumping can always be an adventure with aquatic athletes. Some of them are really good, but I think that some of them also, especially when you get in the plyometric world too, and you get things beyond the vertical jumps and seated jumps and those things, and you start to add momentum, things can get a little bit hairy sometimes. What is your take? And this is probably a little bit of a can of worms on this one, but what is your take on stretching for swimmers?
I guess if I answered it and said stretching is bad, then people would say, no. We saw clips from NBC of you statically stretching Michael. So I guess let me answer it this way. We know that it's a chronic adaptation sport, right? So there's going to be some adaptive shortening in a lot of the muscle groups that are the primary movers of swimming. So we know we have to elongate that, right? Like there's no, you can't debate that, or they're going to get hurt. So I guess you go sit on that end. And then we go into the whole static versus dynamic stretching debate, right? Where static stretching decreases force output. So why would you do that to an athlete in an athletic population? And then you get into, well, the hypermobile, hyperlax athletes, why you want to kind of exacerbate or aggravate a pathology or a symptom that they already have. So I think I've blabbled and not given an answer, but my answer being be a good coach and know your athlete and your athlete's body. And then understand what works in your overall program, right? So let's say if they lift beforehand. In our program, we always lifted after. Again, I said we keep important. What's important and important was swimming, 200 butterfly. So we always lifted after. But let's say you lift them before, and then they're going to go sit around on deck, look at the workout, wish that it wasn't as long, wish there was more fast stuff, wish, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So their body's going through some morphological change. I'd much rather do something to help elongate the adaptively shortened tissue than just sit there and do nothing, because science says static stretching decreases force output. I don't want to increase laxity in a hypermobile glenohumeral joint, so I'm not going to do anything, you know, like, so, you know, is foam rolling, is that stretching, is it fascial work? I mean, it kind of depends on what the person's actually doing, right? So anything you can do to help facilitate elongating those adaptive shortenings so that you don't start getting into those tendinopathy issues that arise in the athlete, I support.
Yeah,
does that give you any sort of answer, or did I avoid the question and dodge it like a politician?
No, I think you answered it pretty well, Keen. I saved the more controversial one, the one that requires a little bit more fine-tuned answer for the end of the podcast. We didn't start out with that one, but I think you did well with that. Thanks for that piece of information, and I got a lot of that answer myself. The last is what, and kind of along a similar lines, the whole take on injury prevention, things like that is, and last question I have for you is, what is the best approach to shoulder stability and preventing shoulder issues in swimming? So obviously this could be a very long answer, but in maybe 10 minutes or less, or less if you like, what is your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so we know that the number one problematic area in a swimming athlete is the shoulder, right? And shoulder pathology. And then it becomes, what caused it? Is it the volume they swim in the water? Is it the bad weight movement activity that Joel was doing, right? Like there's so many things, and it's never just one thing. But one thing that we do know is that our most gifted swimmers, and most of our swimmers, are swimming because they have that hypermobility in the glenohumeral joint. So is it a bad thing or is it a good thing? I would contend it's a good thing, but it's our job to be very meticulous and very careful on what we do to stabilize that and enhance the things that we really can enhance in the weight room. Like we can really make a change in parascapular strength, parascapular endurance, we can make a huge change in what we do to the anterior ribs, the cervical region, in terms of what we do or what we choose to omit from our program, because we know that the pecs and the anterior delts and the internal rotators work at 3-to-1 ratio to everything on the backside of the shoulder. So being careful and meticulous with what we do there. And then I think second saying that is understanding that no domain that goes into the athlete's development is exclusive or is better. So meaning like don't be so prideful that you think like you have the answers to everything. Like you're in a great setting where you have a massage therapist like Cyrus Poitier, man, who can get their bodies going and have some input into what's going on from a soft tissue standpoint. And then you can go through and do the dynamic stability exercises to enhance the rotator cuff, right? Like we can't make the rotator cuff quote unquote stronger. It's really tough to break down skeletal muscle in the rotator cuff, but we can and really enhance what their major function is, which is centralizing the humeral head within the glenoid fossa, right? So and understanding where to program that, which I think is something that I've definitely had to learn the hard way and some trial and error, where the dynamic stabilization, that's a CNS activity, right? So when do I program that? Do I program that after they've swam or at the end of the week? Probably not. They probably just aren't going to get as much firing from the brain to that pathway to keep the good stabilization. But if I spend the first half of the week resetting that and programming that, eventually there's going to be some sort of learning pattern within the athlete and the brain and the whole system that will maybe help keep it centered a little bit better throughout the week. But inevitably, there's going to be fatigue. And so those rotator cuff muscles will shut down. They're going to increase their laxity. And then the big primary muscles are going to take over.
Yeah, that's it's to me in my journey in that of like muscle testing and muscle strength testing. And I've kind of started to become of the opinion that if the rotator cuff is strong and it tests strong, then I don't think that you need to necessarily be cranking away at, a bunch of band based rotator cuff exercises. But like you're saying, once those compensations kick in, then I think that's where things get much more important in terms of fixing and correcting those patterns.
Yeah, and just the dynamic stabilization. So any sort of perturbary work that you can do on them, I think it really helps click the brain to thinking dynamic stabilization. And so I went a lot back into post-surgical cuff research when I was trying to like answer the question of shoulder health for swimmers. And so that was the best. Best route that I found. So those were the most degenerative rotator cuffs, right? Post-surgical. What were the initial steps that they used to get that, A, the firing pattern back, and B, some sort of tissue health and quality going on? And so I thought that would make the most sense when programming cuff and shoulder care for the swimmers. And, the low-level isometric work, fantastic. And our population are N. So in the scientific world, not big enough, but under diagnostic ultrasound with some of our population, when we introduced isometric activities to our cuffs, so we basically went through our special test and just had them do isometric positions of our special test, we really saw an improvement under diagnostic ultrasound of our tissue integrity of our cuff muscles.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's good stuff. For those listeners out there, when you're talking about isometrics, you're just talking about basically training the typical rotator cuff exercises, but in an isometric format rather than using a band.
Yeah, that's it. And then, if you are gonna do some of those internal external rotation movements, I like to put them in position and then just use the perturbations, whether at the wrist or whether at the elbow or even up close to the shoulder joint, to just get the body firing sequencing so that they keep that as best possibly centered within the glenohumeral joint.
Awesome. Good stuff. Well, thank you for your answers there. And then great show, Keenan. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today. I know that the niche of swim strength is not the biggest one, but I think that answers and conversation like this is a really important part of the community. So thank you for your time here on the show today.
Well, Joel, again, thank you for having me. It's quite an honor, quite humbling to have a guy like yourself who had such an outstanding summer. And for all of your listeners out there, Joel is much too humble, but in terms of an impact into a population from quadrennium to quadrennium, so in the Olympic world we lived 4 years, man, this dude was a catalyst, outlier, game changer. So to be able to speak with you, Joel, is quite an honor and very humbling.
Thank you so much. I totally appreciate it, man. You're too kind with that. Thank you. Well, until next time, everybody, we'll see you guys next week. Well, that's it for the show today. Thanks for tuning in with us. Please visit our sponsor, simplyfaster.com, suppliers of fine high-end training technology products such as K-Box, 1080 Sprint, GymAware. We'll be back with another great guest for next week's show. We'll see you then.